From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. We're joined, as always, with our super producer, Alexis, codenamed Doc Holliday Jackson. Most importantly, you are you. You are here. And that makes this the stuff they don't want you to know. It's our favorite time of the year, folks. We hope that this show finds you well amid grand and perhaps creepy adventure as we barrel forward into the future toward Halloween. Today, we are sharing a number of stories that we feel are both amusing, important, and as always, increasingly relevant. And they come from the best part of the show, which is your fellow conspiracy realist. Matt, Noel, I'd like to kick us off today, if it's okay with you guys. How are we feeling?
Sorry. Sounds
good. Right. Okay. So, bit of background here. Before we get into some of this correspondence, as you may or may not know, our team does this on a professional level. Like, it is, weirdly enough, through a series of amazing coincidences, coinkadinks, we have ended up working in podcast production, all of us, for a number of years. And this means that we are, in a way, part of the entertainment industry. Now, make no mistakes, folks. We're not bragging. We're not big deals. Who's like the biggest deal in entertainment or in like film and TV? Who's like the when you think of big deal, who do you think of? Is like J.J. Abrams, like Lorne Michaels, or Oprah Winfrey? Would that count?
I don't know. The lion from the Metro Goldwyn Mayer opening title.
Oh yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
He's a big deal. He knows it too.
Nobody's bigger than Adam Sandler.
No one is bigger than Adam Sandler, except perhaps the characters he plays, such as the lunch lady. He's a man of a million voices. So
I don't know, man. I think he does about two. He just kind of uses different.
Yeah, I didn't say a million different voices.
Okay, got it. I will say I would watch a whole movie about the lunch lady. That would be a delight.
Yes, you say that now. So we have, for our first piece of listener correspondence, we're actually going to synthesize and summarize the excellent and thorough letters we received from two people working in the entertainment industry. When we say entertainment industry, we're specifically talking about film, TV, streaming, that kind of stuff. The stuff that everybody ran to amid the pandemic to escape the at times emotionally penurious existence of a forced hermitage. So our first letter arrives to us from the Duchess of Shoulder Fade. Shoulder Fade is all one word. I like that nickname.
Is that a type of hairdo? Shoulder fade?
No. Unclear with a code name. Unclear. The significance of the code name is unclear, but surely the Duchess will write back to us with an explanation if they see you so fit. So here we go. The Duchess writes from within the bowels of this industry and says in part, quote, "As we speak, Hollywood Fat Cat studio executives, known by the abbreviation AMPTP, are actively trying to continue their exploitation of thousands of hardworking and highly trained artists who they abuse every single day. The public, who actively consumes the fruits of our body and mind-depleting labors, needs to be aware of how and at what cost their entertainment sausage is made. If anyone is against unfair and unhealthy labor practices and conditions, then they must support the IOTC crew members that are literally dying making content so you can, quote, Netflix and chill." So the AMPTP that the Duchess is referring here to is something called the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers. And IOTC is a union. It stands for International Alliance of Theater and Stage Employees. And as the Duchess explains, it represents all of the people that work in theater and film and TV production that are considered below the line. Below the line is an important distinction. This is, in a way, it's almost everybody on the other side of the camera. All of the people who are making this vision, this story, this experience possible. IATSE, the Duchess says, does not represent actors, directors, assistant directors, producers, or production assistants, who PAs, by the way, probably get the fuzziest end of the figurative lollipop here. This division, this line that people refer to, means that people above the line, those actors, writers, directors, producers, tend to be paid better. They tend to be treated better. They tend to have superior working conditions. As the Duchess explains, their information specifically pertains to the 13 West Coast locals. They make up the motion picture and television department of IATSE. They represent cinematographers, art directors, prop makers, makeup artists, costume designers, editors, script supervisors, and many more. So here's what's going on. There is a strike brewing. It's been brewing for some time, and this is information that is not going to be new to our many fellow listeners who work in this industry. The people in the union, and the Duchess says, of course, don't want to go on strike, but they're literally fighting for their lives and asking not for an opulent, but only for a sustainable standard of living. They recommend checking out the Instagram page IA_stories. If you would like to learn more about specific individuals' experiences, shared anonymously, of course, for fear of reprisal from the industry. And the Duchess goes on specifically to name a couple of things we'd like to share with you, the things that IATSE is striving to make reality. And when you hear these, if you're not familiar with the industry, it will probably surprise you. Like, the stuff that these folks are fighting for will seem, it'll give you a cold shower of a perspective. First, the idea of daily turnaround, which means all union members, all locals, get a 10-hour guaranteed minimum before they have a turnaround. Secondly, they want to stop working mission creep into working on the weekends. They want weekend turnaround. The industry term for this is Fraturday. As you can imagine, that means a Friday shoot that eventually ends up being, in actuality, a Saturday shoot. They also don't want to continue the practice of what's called rolling lunches. A rolling lunch is where filming never stops. Crew members rotate themselves out for a break. And the Duchess says that the problem with this is that in realistic terms, there's often not enough crew to rotate out because everybody has a specific job. It's not like everyone can do every job. Someone may be a world-class cinematographer, but they don't know the first thing about hair and makeup, and they shouldn't have to.
Ben, just a quick question, just to clarify. So turnaround just refers to literally the time in between shifts. Like,
yes.
Otherwise, it becomes like a double shift, like that Fraturday thing you're talking about, right?
Correct. And the problem is exacerbated when you have someone who, say, works one of those infamous Fraturdays and then has very little turnaround time before they have to be back on set. And keep in mind, you know, a lot of these professionals have to be on location way before filming actually occurs. There's a ton of work, hours and hours and hours of work that goes into a shoot before the rest, like the on-camera folks, arrive. Also, they want a living wage for the lowest paid IATSE members, some of whom barely make above minimum wage or considered on-call, which means they work however many hours it takes, and they only get paid the same amount every week. Then they also want overall wage increases, better funding for health and pension plans, and here's the big one. Improvements to what are called new media wages and conditions. I'm going to read this part in full. So back 6 years ago, says the Duchess, when streaming was new and people were making web series, IATSE added a side agreement to the basic agreement that allowed what was at the time called new media, that's your Netflix, your Amazon, your Hulu, Crackle back in the day, to have special contracts that essentially gave them a price break. This was a new form of production. No one understood it at the time. IATSE agreed to work for less money in order to help the new platform make content and be successful. The term new media is obsolete now. It's streaming. It's no longer new. Amazon, Netflix, Peacock, Disney, HBO, they're all studios who stream their content, and they are not struggling new media platforms. IATSE wishes to modify these contracts. Many of them have very low rates that exploit those below-the-line workers. Streaming media has just as huge budget as regular network TV, even larger in some cases. They should no longer be able to pay those measly new media rates. They're making millions off streaming, yet want to continue getting these breaks.
Well, now everything's streaming. I mean, Warner Brothers is streaming every single movie on their slate for the year, in addition to putting it out in theaters because of COVID. So, I mean, that is the very definition of an industry exploiting essentially a loophole or a term that, like, they're talking about web series, like, that were just put out on YouTube independently. That's literally so that people making those could afford to hire union crew. And now these big, massive companies are totally exploiting that whole term. That is painfully exploitive.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And it's also, you know, it reminds me of the old observation that is unfortunately so often true. Power is rarely given. It must often be taken. So the Duchess goes on, and we are summarizing some of this, but goes on to explain real world consequences of people who are laboring under these conditions. Even before COVID, of course, it's normal to have these long, long work hours, going into a shoot at 7 a.m. on a Friday, getting off at 3 a.m. on Saturday the next day. The Duchess notes crew members are dying when they're driving home after working 15, 16, 17 hour shifts with minimal sleep. And this clearly has an impact on people's quality of life, their relationships outside of the job. This is an unsustainable situation. Duchess, I want to thank you for this thorough and objective look at the problems that are occurring, what's leading to this strike. And I believe we were in conversations off air. The union's vote on the strike occurs between October 1st and October 3rd. So you're going to be hearing this after the voting has occurred. Duchess ends with saying, "I just want the folks that consume and enjoy what we make to hear our stories and to let the studios, which are literally owned by giant tech companies now, know they stand with IATSE. We're not Hollywood elite," the Duchess says. "We're hardworking craft people that are literally dying making sitcoms. I'm not sure how listeners can help, other than by canceling their streaming memberships, commenting against AMPTP on articles about the situation, or maybe calling out studios on social media." So this is, Matt, no, let's just a quick pause before we continue. This is something I think that we at all, we and Doc and Mission Control had heard about brewing, because Atlanta is a bit of an up and coming town for film and TV production. Would you agree?
I mean, I wouldn't even call it up and coming anymore. It's sort of the place, you know,
Yollywood. I mean,
they built Pinewood Studios, is where they shot all the original, like, James Bond movies in London, or in England, in the UK. And they, the second, only second ever Pinewood Studios is here in Atlanta, where they shoot like all the Marvel movies. I mean, it's become like home base. So yeah, we all know people who, or have dated people perhaps, or good dear friends with people who have been subjected to these kind of conditions for years. You both, I believe, met the girl I dated for a while who was an assistant director, continues to be, and it was hard to find time with her, like, to even hang. Our schedules were so weirdly misaligned, and a lot of it was because of these turnarounds where they were non-existent. It felt like the rules just didn't apply, you know, even with the help of a union. It just seems like the cards are definitely stacked against these folks in a lot of ways, especially, like you said, Ben, the people who need maybe the most help, who are making the least amount of money. I mean, she thankfully was in a pretty pretty fancy position. You know, that sets up the ladder quite a bit. And maybe those people are like, okay, all right, it's worth it. I'll deal with that. You know, then they take all their vacation in one big go. But for folks that are just trying to get their foot in the door, I mean, they're absolutely being taken advantage of.
Yeah. I think comparing Atlanta and LA is very helpful here, but it's also just something that is happening in every major city on the planet right now. The cost of living is going up, but the standard raises that are being seen across the board come nowhere close to meeting the necessary amount of money increase just to live in a city. So, you know, thankfully there is this entity that is fighting back or on behalf of, you know, the IATSE members. It's just, it stinks to think that not everybody has something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. And this is interesting too that you say this, Matt, because multiple studies have found that if minimum wage did rise in step with productivity for the past few decades, since like 1968, the minimum wage would be over $24 or over $25 today. It just hasn't. It hasn't risen. Wages have in a very real way stagnated. And we want to give, before we open up the whole conversation here, we want to give a shout out to one person we can mention by name, Agamemnon. Your name is awesome. Thank you for writing in. Agamemnon is a retired IATSE 695 production sound mixer, worked for almost 50 years in the industry, also wanted to bring the stewing strike to our attention, and more importantly, fellow conspiracy realists, to your attention. For Agamemnon's part, says that the strike is on the way because, or the strike became a possibility because that production group, AMPTP, was stonewalling, ignoring the request of IATSE. And this ultimately, like you said, Matt, this is what these kinds of organizations are explicitly designed to do, to give collective bargaining power, to give voice to people who are often voiceless or ignored. With that in mind, I suggest that we talk just a little bit more about what exactly is going on with the IATSE, what the future of this will be, what the context should be. And, you know, Noel, as you said, yeah, we do know a lot of people who work in production in one capacity or another. You know, these are, in fact, in Atlanta, it would be, I posit at this point, somewhat unusual not to know, at least tangentially, a couple of people. And our big question here is, what does this mean for the future? Again, we are operating under what more stuffy folks might call information asymmetry, which means right now, if you're listening to this when it comes out, you know some things that we do not know yet. You probably know how the vote went, whether or not a strike did come to pass. You probably know whatever new volleys of the information war on social media were made in the intervening time between when we recorded this and when we published it. But one thing that we can say for certain is that even if a strike does not come to pass, the situation appears largely unsustainable. And I think we can't forget what a terrible situation people were already put in when production shut down during the pandemic, right?
Yeah, just having absolutely no work.
Well, and it makes sense then that they're digging their heels in, you know, while on one, out of one side of their mouth, they're expressing solidarity, you know, with the amazing people that make the magic happen and all of that. And so happy that we're all back to work and we're thinking of you and all of this and have done everything we can to make it safe for you to come back to work. But out of the other side of their mouth, they're absolutely capitalizing on the fact that a lot of people are like, well, at least I have a job. At least we're back to work. And if you don't nip that in the bud right away, that's just going to become the status quo forever. You know, there's no question about it. I mean, it's sort of the equivalent of maybe not giving certain benefits back after the pandemic. It's like, oh, well, we're in the same boat as you. You know, production was slowed and all of that. So we're waiting to see when things come back to normal. But I mean, things are pretty much back to normal, at least in terms of like production and new content. And we know nobody's going to stop making content. So why not just sort it all out and make sure everyone's like on the same page? But do you guys, I don't know, I'm saying this, but, and just to look at both sides, do you think there's any validity to this notion that, well, the grosses are still way down and, you know, fewer movies are going to be coming out and everything is now streaming first as opposed to like when we could depend on big opening weekends? What now constitutes a big opening weekend after COVID is far, far, far less than what would have constituted a successful opening weekend before COVID. And again, these are problems that have been brewing way before. Mm-hmm. But I'm just wondering if maybe the timing, you know, has something to do with COVID and if there is somewhere to meet in the middle between the two parties.
Yeah, this leads to one of the some of the closing points I wanted to make it right now as the situation stands. You are correct. And in that the production side of this, their argument from the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers is that the overall industry is still very much in recovery from COVID. They also state that they had offered the union a plan for better wages, longer rest periods, and more funding for pension and health plans. But the thing is, people like the communications director for IATSE, Jonas Loeb, speaking with NPR, don't agree that AMPTP ever did that. The thing is, you know, you could say, oh, there's some sort of like exaggeration or emotional manipulation. But yes, the truth of the matter is people are being overworked and they are driving in dangerous conditions. Those are not fictitious stories. It's not like that Hill and Knowlton testimony that led to the Gulf War. This is a story about things that actually happened. Woo, I walked down the street to throw that shade, but I hope it landed. One more thing. I know we're going long on this, but it's just really important to a lot of people who have asked us to share this story. Our own codename Doc Holliday has pointed out, for anybody who wants to learn more, wants to take action, if you want to learn more, do check out the Instagram page, IA_stories, is created by industry lighting technician named Ben Gottlieb. And you can read a lot of accounts of the consequences of this situation. But this is what Doc pointed out. You can do more than just cancel a streaming service if you would like. Per the Duchess's suggestion, there is also a petition making the rounds. All you have to do is, I think it's as simple as just searching your internet browser choice for IATSE petition, IATSE, and you don't have to be in the union to sign this petition. It's just a public show of support. And of course, as we mentioned in our earlier strange news this week, there is an open question regarding the actual effectiveness of petitions. Noel, I think it was you who raised that point when Matt was telling us a little bit about proposed deep sea mining.
Yeah, I wasn't meaning to be cynical, but I appreciate the solidarity that allows folks to express. But I just don't know that I've ever seen a petition alone cause, you know, a giant, powerful entity to make a change. Unless it benefited them.
Right. And there we see, you know, of course, there's still questions about petitions. The use of petitions itself may be an interesting twist for a future episode, spoiler alert. But for now, this is the information we have. There is much, much more out there. If you're interested, we encourage you, as always, to learn more. If you are hearing this and you yourself work in the industry, we would also like to hear your stories. We would like to hear your opinions. And honestly, at this point, if you're listening now and you've got some of that time off, then turn it off. Go hang out with your family. Don't feel like you have to hang out with us. Please rest up. Please be safe. But if you do want to contact us, as always, 1-833-STD-WYTK, conspiracy@iheartradio.com. We're going to pause, take a little break ourselves for a word from our sponsors, and we will be back with more news from you.
Hello, welcome back. I was going to play this voicemail, but unfortunately the audio broke up a little bit. It comes from someone named Matt. This person mentioned to us just a really interesting question that I had never really pondered before. Why on earth would any unidentified aerial phenomena have lights? What is the purpose of a light for a spacefaring craft that can perhaps travel across galaxies? Why would they need actual visible spectrum lights on their craft? Go.
For landing. Same reason airplanes need them. Airplanes don't need them to see. They need them for visibility from other craft. Or, for, you know, to communicate, perhaps.
It's like how wearing the mask is supposed to protect other people from an infection, not protect you.
Got you. Okay, you know, I see that. Like, the point it took me down was that, well, if this craft has sufficient technology to traverse those vast distances, wouldn't they have some kind of technology to detect when there are other things in range of them, where exactly in space those things are, where it is in relation to a planet, let's say, that is going to land on, or any other body? Like, why would you need to project out with a visible spectrum light where you are and to be able to see where you're landing?
If it's a craft.
Well, we know that, I guess our best place to start with that, Matt, would be the idea of external lights on human-made spacecraft, right? I mean, it's clearly not a fair comparison, because any extraterrestrial manufactured or ultra-dimensional, want to get fun with it, manufactured craft would probably have something, to your point, that's far superior to the detection capabilities of conventional lights. In the case of human beings, the lights are needed to first identify the vehicle, right? But also to identify possible crevices on the craft. People still need lights if they're doing EVA repairs or something like that. You would need lights if you want to get a slick photo op, et cetera, because people just unfortunately aren't super impressed with graphs of light that is invisible to the human eye. It is also a great question because, you know, I thought of this years ago, and I can't remember if we ever talked about it, but let's say you have one of the crafts that science fiction writers have dreamed about for centuries, a craft that can go faster than the speed of light. It's not doing a little like a wrinkle in time kind of teleportation. It's not doing an event horizon, dropping a black hole kind of deal. It's just going faster than light. Then wouldn't the spacebound equivalent of headlights be useless? Because you're going faster than the light they produce.
Well, yeah, they only turn on after you stop.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Not to mention if there's anything that that movie, what is it, Arrival did? It just goes to show. So we have no frame of reference for like what any alien species, how they communicate, how they perceive the world. You know, we base everything around perception of the visible light spectrum and like perceiving objects with our eyes. Who knows if that's even the way their physiology works, you know? It could all be with some form of telepathy or with any number of other ways. Like visible light, you know, isn't necessarily something that's like that universal. I mean, it is obviously on our planet, but who the hell knows what's going on anywhere else? So it's a good point. I think it's interesting to think about, right?
I think so too.
Does that make sense what I'm saying? Like the idea that like, I think we are basing everything around our equipment, you know, as human beings, whereas there could be others that maybe there's a whole another kind of perception that we are not even aware of, in the same way that we might not have any grasp of the kinds of technologies that we're talking about. You know, this is always what comes up.
Oh, hold on. Are you telling me and all the people listening to this show that humans might have a tendency to be disgustingly self-centered?
A little bit.
if you want to describe that if you want to put a tie on that concept so you can take it with you to fancy dinner parties, just start using the phrase anthrocentric.
Mm-hmm. Anthrocentric as hell over here.
I know. But you're Matt, I feel like you were about to say something.
Yes, I am going to say something because a little spark happened while I was thinking about this. And I've got an answer for you about why there are lights on UAPs that we see. Snap.
Here we go. We
talked about this whole thing. The other thing that we can kind of tie in after this and compare these two is that if it's a super secret, let's say, stealth aircraft of some kind that's being tested, why on earth would they not disable the lights? Why would Lockheed and Skunk Works not disable the lights when it's functioning, right? At least over a certain part of the U.S. or wherever it's functioning, just to maintain that cover of darkness, lack of light. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, though, what if it's bioluminescence?
Oh, nice.
Now, here's why I think it's interesting. We just talked about drilling. We just talked about drilling in the abyssal plane deep beneath the oceans. Now, we talked about how there are so many similarities between that realm and the realm in space, right? There's a little problem of a lack of, you know, oxygen or any other substance that a biological creature could breathe, at least to our knowledge, to our understanding. But in the abyssal plane, bioluminescence, there's so many reasons to have it. Not only for communication and being able to see. I mean, it's just everything you need as a creature in the bottom of the sea. You can achieve a ton of it through bioluminescence, including getting your
good
food.
Good call. Yeah. And recently, just like very recently, I think the news just hit today, in fact, southeastern pocket gophers here in Georgia turn out to be bioluminescent. There's a lot more. I know. And no one knows why yet. No one knows why.
I love the idea of a pocket gopher, though. Is that like a Tamagotchi?
I know. I hit you guys with a lot in one sentence. Sorry. Yes, there are things called pocket gophers, and they glow, and no one knows why. They're in South Georgia and a couple of other states. No connection with extraterrestrials, but this I love the point about bioluminescence, Matt. That's my next speculation was going to be something like maybe the light is a side effect of whatever power source is moving the thing. And those two answers may not be, you know, mutually exclusive, right? It could be both bioluminescence and a power source, or pocket gophers. I don't know. I'm taking this in now.
If it was pocket badgers, it would be so much better. Gosh,
it would be so much more on brand. Yeah. Also, flying squirrels, wombats, and platypuses are apparently bioluminescent.
Oh my gosh. Well, see, that's incredible.
And I'm done.
Possums. Obviously, this is a thought experiment. We're speculating here.
Sure.
It's a fun thing to do, but it's also a way to expand the way we look at these things, right? So perhaps there's something out there glowing up because it just it naturally and it's a living being. Or I love what you said there, Ben. Perhaps it's just an effect of whatever the power source is, whatever energy source exists there. Or maybe there are no extraterrestrial craft up there, but it feels less and less likely every day when more and more weird stuff is happening. I don't know. Ooh. I'm just excited about that. And Matt, appreciate you sending us a voicemail. I do apologize. There's a small portion that I can make out until it, whatever occurs in there, there's some errors. So thank you very much.
Oh, yes. Thank you. And also, first off, any Matt is typically a friend of the show. We're very pro Matt here. Also, I just want to keep on this for one moment. I know it's such a tangent.
Yeah, no, please, let's do it.
Correct myself. I was talking about biofluorescence. So they're biofluorescent animals. And one unnamed scientist in a recent article that released today referred to the pocket gopher as, get this, a, quote, homely, belligerent sausage. So let's hope that the aliens aren't on that vibe.
That's the way they view us. These homey, belligerent sausages keep getting into these metal things and driving along painted lines. It's very strange.
The guy who discovered this, J.T. Pynn, P-Y-N-N-E, apologies if I'm mispronouncing your name, sir, said that they've always described pocket gophers as, quote, really angry russet potatoes. So again, let's hope the aliens are cooler. It's such a good question, though. Like, what why would you have lights? It's you know, to your point Noel, about anthrocentrism, what we perceive as lights, if we're talking about a truly alien civilization, would almost certainly not be for the same reason, right? Like, they might not even have eyes. What do you need eyes for? Cans might be weird to them, you know?
Where we're going, yeah, we won't need eyes.
Or hands.
Or roads. Or hands. Or hats. I'm just saying, you know,
we're taking the gophers with us.
Exactly. Oh, boy.
Well, anyway, hey, that was a quick one. But just wanted to have that conversation with you guys. If you have thoughts specifically on why UAP phenomena is almost always light-based, not always, but very often a light-based experience, write to us, email conspiracy@iheartradio.com or 1-833-STD-WYTK. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back with more listener mail.
And we're back. And today's final listener mail comes to us from the guy on the couch. And he says, hi, guys. Greetings from Sweden. First of all, big fan of your show. You always bring interesting topics to the table and it gets my old gray blob working. I guess he's referring to his brain. Never heard of it referred to as the old gray blob, but that is charming and I love it. And I'm going to use it from now on. The other day, over a dinner with some friends, the discussion regarding conspiracies involving stuff like dental and car care came up. For example, the possible scenarios of a dentist intentionally, maybe drilling just a bit too much to make you come back again. Anyways, long story short, we started to talk about bad sight, the possibilities to train your sight back to health once it got bad. And if glasses really are good for you, or is it all part of a bigger thing? Here in Sweden, for example, the opticians have a subscription program where you rent your glasses for a monthly fee. You need to rent 3 pairs at least, and also stuff like appointments and checkups are included. This is shown to be very lucrative for the companies and much less so for the consumers. I'm sure this is not exclusive to Sweden, though. Anyway, awesome show. Keep up the good work. Sincerely yours, the guy on the couch.
Yes, the guy on the couch. People are killing it with these nicknames.
Such good ones. Mm-hmm. And then TGOTC, TGOTC comes back and sends us a couple of links. And surprise, surprise, our old pals Luxottica come up in several of these articles. We've been talking about doing a full episode on this, so I thought maybe we could do a little bit of a primer on how Ellisor Luxottica, because they used to be two companies, and then Ellisor bought Luxottica for about $24 billion, by the way. Mm-hmm. Ellisor was a French company that's been around since the 1800s and just buying up companies as they've gone. So it's one of those legacy companies that has the benefit of, you know, time and generational wealth.
They take the long view. Lens Crafters, Sunglass Hut, Target, Pearle Vision. What else? What else? Ray-Ban. Oakley.
Not only exactly, Ben, you nailed it. Not only those have they bought up over time, but also even like optical insurance companies. They really do have what one might consider a pretty significant monopoly. Let's go through a few more of these. Yeah, we've got Prada. They make them for it, rather. They don't own all of these, but they make glasses and frames for Prada, Chanel, Dolce & Gabbana, Versace, Burberry, Ralph Lauren, Tiffany, Bulgari, Vogue, Persol, Coach, DKNY, and some of these companies they own, some of them they just manufacture for. Lens Crafters they own, Oakley they own, I believe, Ray-Ban they definitely own, sunglasses they own, Target Optical, Pearle Vision, Sears Optical, etc. They also, let's see, they control apparently around 80% of the major brands in the whole world. The industry at large, and this is an article from Forbes from a little ways back. This is from 2014, so it's definitely changed. We need to do some updates, which we will do in the full episode. But in 2014, they controlled something in the neighborhood of 80% of the major brands. And at that time, the eyeglass industry was worth around $28 billion. There is another really cool article that's more recent that came from Vox, where a couple of former Lens Crafter executives walk through why it is that a pair of glasses can get marked up by nearly 1,000%. meaning that, you know, what you pay for the privilege of having these glasses is insanely more than what it costs to make them, which is, you know, how business works. But, you know, when your choices are so limited, then it starts to feel a little weirder. And there certainly are disruptors to this model, like Warby Parker. And I believe Zenni Optical is a really popular one. So you don't have to pay these prices. I don't think anyone's saying that the kind of monopoly that this appears to be is completely disruptive. But if you want to have those Dolce & Gabbana frames or those Ray-Bans, you know, you're gonna pay significantly more than you would for a pair of glasses from Warby Parker that you can get for, like, you know, in the neighborhood of like $30 or $50. A lot of this has to do with the fact that Luxottica is able to kind of set the pricing and the price floor for eyeglasses, because they own so many and, you know, control so much of the means of production for even companies that they don't own. And there was a really cool little graphic that kind of spelled this out on this Forbes article. And it refers to the way that the government does limit price to kind of match what's called marginal cost, but they are able to set the price floor like just, you know, just close enough to meet that government regulation. And guys, in this Forbes article from 2014, it's a great article, but I think we all agree there's this graph that's sort of trying to describe how they're able to set these prices, these price margins, and how governments regulation figures into that. But it looks more like a cross section of a mountain in a geological survey or something than it does like a readable graph. I don't know. Yeah.
I'm seeing an elephant in there somewhere.
Yeah.
There is a bit of an elephant. Yeah.
It's at Rorschach level. It reminds me a little bit. We know a lot of solid work went into this, but just visually, it reminds me a little bit of those PSAs where they would dose spiders with different types of drugs and then see what kind of webs they made. You know, this got a spider on a couple different drugs vibe, a little bit of a family circus. Maps going around. You remember the comic strips where they would just have one panel? It was one of the kids from Family Circus just walking around the neighborhood. It's got that. But what the argument here, what I believe they're saying here, is that it's really comment on the relationship between a monopoly and government regulation of a monopoly. So there are government regulated monopolies, just like Quebec's maple syrup gang. I don't know why that sounds like a cartoon too. The maple syrup gang. They get into
The apple dumpling gang. But I believe that was.
Yeah, that's why. That's why.
Borderline, the maple syrup thing you're talking about is borderline like a cartel, right?
Yeah, it's been called a cartel.
No, I completely agree. And this is a complex issue. And there's a lot of interesting history that I think we're absolutely going to keep this a shorter one. Leonardo del Vecchio, at least at the time of this article back in 2014, was the, you know, living heir to this Luxottica fortune and this whole company. And he's the guy that founded Lens Crafters. And there's a really great article that I need to finish reading all of in The Guardian called "The Spectacular Power of Big Lens, How One Giant Company Will Dominate the Way the Whole World Sees." And that is from just a couple of years ago. So I think that'll be a great resource for the full episode. But there's a pretty incredible couple of sentences that I just wanted to point out and before we close for the day. "On a shelf near the door of the museum, I spotted A Man Who Sees Far, an official Luxottica biography of Del Vecchio, which was published in 1991. I expected the optical world to be genteel and polite and was taken aback whenever conversation has turned to the personal charisma and menace of Del Vecchio. He's the godfather," said Dean Butler, who founded Lens Crafters in 1983. "Del Vecchio bought it in 1995. Excuse me, I misspoke earlier. He bought Lens Crafters in 1995, just like they bought all these other properties that we've been talking about. Here's the kicker. The godfather to me is the guy. He runs it. Honestly, he kind of rules by fear. Very few opticians would even mention Del Vecchio's name, lending him a Voldemort-like aura for fear of offending him, however unlikely that might be. One talked about getting a horse's head in the bed and concluded our interview by saying, 'You can quote me as long as it sounds like I am sucking Del Vecchio's d-.'"
Wow.
So and he was like, leave that last part in too.
Right.
Yeah. Make sure. Like, yeah. Okay.
All this to say, I want to know more about this Del Vecchio character and the history of the family that led to this essential, you know, sunglasses, eyeglasses cartel where they own, you're right, Ben, it's this particular type of resin that they use to make these glasses that is like they own the patent on it. It's a particular type of resin. So let's do it. I mean, this is like, there's some fascinating stuff in here. And I want to read this biography too, because again, it's the official biography, by the way, which probably is going to paint him in a very positive light.
Did you see the official response at the end of that Forbes article saying that?
I did.
Look, we love what you're saying here. We get it. Yeah, we have some awesome stuff. We make a lot of great things, but we only manufactured around 10% of all the eyeglasses sold last year. So, you know, we're not quite a monopoly. And it's true. But if you go to a glasses store to get your eyes checked, they're all up in there.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So let's leave it there for today. Thank you, the TGOC, the guy on the TGOTC, or the guy on the couch, for shooting us these links. And we are going to explore this in depth in an upcoming episode. In the meantime, if you want to take a cue from the guy on the couch, and who else do we have today, guys?
We also had the Duchess of Shoulder Fade.
Yes, of course. How could I forget Agamemnon, the Duchess of Shoulder Fade?
Much more famous than the mythological version.
And another Matt, if I'm not mistaken. Yep.
Yes.
You want to take a cue from all of them, your fellow conspiracy realists? You can find us on the internet. We are in all of the usual places of note, Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. You can find us at the handle Conspiracy Stuff. And on Instagram, we're Conspiracy Stuff Show.
And if that doesn't quite bag your badgers, you're not a fan of sipping the social meads, never fear, you can contact us directly. You can give us a telephone call. We are 1-833-STDWYTK. 3 minutes. Those minutes are yours. Give yourself a cool nickname or moniker. Let us know what's on your mind. Let us know if we can use your voice and or message on the air. Perhaps most importantly, if your story needs more than 3 minutes, if you have links, if you have photographic evidence that you would like to share with us, we would like to hear it in full. Never feel like you have to edit yourself. Instead, pull up your email thingamajig of choice and send us a good old-fashioned electronic letter. Where we are.
Conspiracy at iHeartRadio.com. Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.